Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Jamie Stewart from Juju. Jamie, boy, it's great to have you back on the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And I'm also joined here with Pill Eater, Richard Wollstonecraft, and Harlem Venison.
Hi there.
Hey, how's it going?
Greetings from down under. It's a regular love-in, and we've got lots of important things to discuss, like that season finale of Twin Peaks, for example. What did you all make of that? Jamie, what was your impressions? You're someone who's worked on the music of Twin Peaks, doing your own interpretation of it recently. What did you think of the ending, if you saw it?
Well, I feel very mixed about it.
Me too.
I thoroughly appreciate that it was a challenging ending.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, as a David Lynch fan, one of the things I like most about his work is that he demands a lot from the audience. I think, along with most people, find it rather confusing, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but I think because of that, I've had a difficult time really digesting it. It will probably require a repeated viewing, which is a good sign, so I feel ambiguous, but positively ambiguous about it. What do you think?
I think I'll like it when I watch it again. My initial reaction was not that positive, because I don't know, I just felt that after the whole Dougie Jones thing a bit, you know, like where Cooper spent most of season three, well, as someone else, well, obviously as Mr. C, the bad Cooper. And, you know, we really didn't get much actual Cooper at all. He was only around for an episode or two. And also it was weird the way he spent the whole time getting out of the Black Lodge, and then he was sort of back in it again for a little while there. It's like now he can come and go as he pleases. It's, you know, without, you know, like...
Jamie, when you released your album, Juju Plays the Music of Twin Peaks, were you anticipating the release of the new Twin Peaks, or was it purely a coincidence?
It was just, I think, just fortuitous timing on our part. We had been commissioned to do it, and then in Australia, actually, and then the day that we arrived there to do it, the person who curated the show is friends with David Lynch and told us that there was going to be a new season. So it was just a happy coincidence.
You have a whole bunch of songs from Audrey's Dance to Into the Night. Do you have a favorite of one of the original scores by Badalamenti?
Sycamore Tree is my favorite.
I would have to say it's I forget the name off the top of my head. Is it the not the Roadhouse Boys, is the Bookhouse Boys. I think that's my favorite.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
What did you think of the soundtrack on the new series? What did you think of all the musical acts that sort of ended up most episodes at the Double R? I got the soundtrack the other day. It came out luckily. Have you heard that yet?
I wasn't that into it. I mean, I like the Nine Inch Nails song.
Me too.
And I like... I can't remember what the band was, but the band that David Lynch's son played in and Dean Hurley played in, I like that song.
Was it the Chromatics?
Not the Chromatics. It's like a made up band for the show, I think.
Yeah, I think that was like the one that was a bit like the Red Room song. It was kind of the
Dune Loom. Yeah, and a friend of mine from Alex Lang from Dirty Beach played on that. I thought that was cool. But the rest of it, it's not really my style of music or my musical taste so much.
Have you heard from David Lynch? Has he reacted to your version? Have you heard from his camp in relation to the record you released?
Yeah, we met him. He was super generous about it and very, 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 very kind to us. We played a music festival in the year. Got to meet him then. Both he and Angelo Badalamenti have been very, very nice to us. It's kind of mind-boggling.
That's good news, isn't it?
Richard, you were telling me you have a personal Juju story. Do you want to go ahead?
Okay. Slightly controversial, so keep your hat on, boys and girls. Obviously, I've been aware of your band for a little while. I think you're one of the more impressive bands that's come out the last 10 or 15 years. The Australian edition of Fabulous Muscles, which has an extra track, apparently. Australian bonus track. So that's kind of interesting. And how I I most got into you, oddly enough. I was shooting a film I made for The Last Days of Joe Blow, which was about the porn industry. And we were sort of, I was hanging out with a lot of porn stars and this guy, Michael Tierney, who's a nephew of Lawrence Tierney. He became a porn star called Joe Blow, and I made a documentary about him. Anyway, we decided to, we're in LA, we decided to kind of party one night. So we went saw a drug dealer, and we got some cocaine. And this woman was really, really high on coke. And obviously I won't say who it is or anything or where, but like, and she was blasting your music at like, you know, 11. And it was extraordinary. We were doing lines and listening to it. And I go, this is fucking incredible. And it was kind of also disturbing. And it was, I mean, especially that level she was, the volume she was playing it at. It was like, I just said, I've got to get into this. And then obviously after that, I went up to, what's the name of that record store up on Sunset? It's quite famous, Amoeba. And, picked up a few more of your records and, I've been a fan since. But I've been trying to find a place to get them locally as well. But, I think some of your stuff comes out through a major chain called JB Hi-Fi Down Under. But the last two albums haven't come out and I've yet to order them on Amazon. So I've been a bit slack there. But I listened to them both on online before we did this just to catch up.
Thank
so
you very your much.
Album sounds great. Sorry?
It's probably just the cocaine. Thank you.
Jamie, do you want to talk about your most recent album, Forget? This came out in February of this year.
Oh, I mean, I don't think that I could just start spieling about it, but if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
What originally inspired this album, and do you have a particular song you'd like to talk about?
It's not, I mean, it's hard to say what it's, I mean, none of our records are really concept records, so it's difficult to say what inspired a particular record. I mean, we just kind of deal with things on a song-by-song basis, and then when we have enough songs, the record is done. That is a terrible answer, but I don't think that I can answer, I don't know if I can really answer that question, because I don't think there really is an answer to what inspired the record as a whole.
I would like to say that, you know, as somebody who grew up in rural New Hampshire back in, you know, a teenager in, say, 2003, I remember that finding Juju's music on like Napster or something, and it was like a phantom from the outside world, and it really moved me as a tumultuous adolescent. So thanks, brother. You know.
Oh. Thank you.
I mean, seriously, it's interesting to be speaking with you on the phone right now.
Oh, thanks very much. That's nice of you to say.
Yeah.
How do you come up with the different song names? So in your most recent album, Forget, you have a lot of interesting names. One of them is Queen of the Losers. You have a Hey Choco Bananas.
Hey Choco Bananas is, I just saw it. It just means we have chocolate bananas. It's a sign that I saw at a store in my neighborhood. My bandmate Angela saw, and I just like to eat chocolate bananas at a Paletta place nearby. So it's just kind of a little, it's almost just like a little cute nod to the neighborhood. Frequently, a lot of the titles don't really have any direct connection to the song. This is so fucking pretentious. A lot of the titles themselves are almost just like a, at times just like an inside nod to different things related to people in the band or but maybe just an interesting, I mean, there may be a song that I, you know, that has like a normal chorus, but I don't want to just name it after the chorus. It's just an attempt to try to find some other potentially and hopefully interesting turn of phrase.
And you collaborated with a number of artists, including Vaginal Davis.
Yeah. She's been a hero of mine since I was a very young teenager. It's a real privilege to get to do something with her.
Yes, I listened to a few tracks off that just last night. It sounds very impressive. And does it have a on the cover? Is that a Muslim symbol on the front? Is that Arabic?
It doesn't have any religious affiliation. It's just in Arabic. Yeah.
Does that mean the title? Forget.
It means we forget. There's no direct translation to just forget in Arabic. There has to be some pronoun before it.
Fair enough. Have you ever toured Australia before? And you said there was an Australian connection in relation to Twin Peaks. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah. We played Australia several times. We were just there a couple months ago. Yeah, the GOMA, the Gallery of Modern Art in Brisbane, commissioned us to play the music of Twin Peaks. And we had initially thought it was only going to be at that one show. But I think because the show was, we only thought there was going to be that one concert, but because season 3 came up at the time we were playing that, there was a renewed interest in the show. So we started getting asked to play a bunch of shows. I think the last one we're going to do, I think, next January in Chicago. And I think we're going to hang it up after that.
Because there was a big David Lynch exhibit up in Queensland, wasn't there?
At that gallery. Yeah. That's the one we played at. It was related to that exhibit.
Oh, wow. So they brought you out to actually play for it when David Lynch was there or not?
Yeah. Oh, no, it wasn't when he was there, but he was there at one point. But it was that same exhibit, yeah.
Well, that's fascinating stuff. So what else is going on in the world? What other problems of the world can we solve? What do you think about these hurricane situation? Are we going to talk current events and Donald Trump and all that kind of stuff?
God, I don't think I have it in me. Yes. I mean, it's
hurricane fatigue.
He already occupies so much of my fucking brain space. I would love to not talk about him. How are things in Australia in that regard as of late? It seems a pretty complex time there as well.
Yes, we've got a gay marriage vote coming up, which is like a yes or no.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Yeah, I think the polls say that it will be a yes, which means it'll go ahead. But it could end up one of those Brexit kind of moments. And I've spoken to different people. I mean, I guess I'm a little bit in two minds in relation to it. Obviously, I don't have a problem with the idea of two people getting married, but of any as long as they're adults, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't know. There seems to be another kind of agenda also that's somehow like what's called the globalists or mainstream US media has attached itself to the gay and lesbian agenda and is promoting it. It seems to be a sort of a destabilization towards the traditional notion of the family and stuff. Now, that's a conservative idea. I don't know if I even fully buy it myself, but there's certainly something else going on outside of, and I think I preferred the gay movement when it was underground. I mean, I used to run a club called the Hellfire Club that was like an S&M nightclub in the 1990s.
In your film Pearls Before Swine, there's even a scene of homoerotic S&M.
There is. And a couple other different S&M kind of things that starred Boyd Rice. You're probably familiar with Boyd. James. And it's all very interesting, I think. I guess I've always been, a natural contrarian and a devil's advocate a bit. So I guess the way that the left is kind of in a Gramscian sense occupies the kind of social discourse space at the moment, that being sure. a bit right or conservative on things is interesting, and I think at least opens dialogue. And a lot of people don't like that. A lot of my more smart left-wing friends, and I have many, many of whom are even Marxists, who preferred Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton, maybe logical reasons, but some of Steve Bannon's program in relation to, nationalism and, putting tariffs on imports from companies who outsource.
Oh, so like David Thrussell, who we have on the show.
Have a vague socialist kind of feel to them. So, I saw that 60 Minutes interview with Steve Bannon. That was kind of interesting as well. Did you see that?
Oh, yeah, I saw clips of it. I didn't see the whole thing.
Hey, Jamie, what's your stance on the alt-right and Charlottesville and all that?
What the fuck do you think it is? I mean, they're fucking Nazi fascists. I think they're fucking full of shit.
Okay.
Fucking a lightning bolt should strike them off the face of the fucking earth. Like any fucking sentient, sane person thinks that. There's no fucking opinion to be had. It's just a fact. They're fucking garbage. They're not even like people. There's nothing to think about.
Amen.
It's like asking me, like, what I think about child rape. Like, what the fuck you say?
How do we defeat them?
I think the Outright is a little bit broader than.
I don't have any idea.
I think the Outright is a little bit broader than these kind of neo-Nazi kind of what you call them, cosplay LARPers or whatever you want to call them, who, you know, dress up and, you know, sing Nazi kind of slogans, like what was the thing that they were singing, Blood and Soil. It was ridiculous. I mean, you know, called Unite the Right. It basically destroyed the alt-right, as far as I could see.
I don't care. I don't know.
On a lighter note, I guess I would ask Jamie thoughts about Erasure. We were actually just talking about Erasure. I'm wondering if...
Fantastically,
hard yeah.
Transition.
Yeah. So yeah, I was curious because there were some covers of Erasure in your music, and maybe you want to talk about lighter music like that. I actually just saw Depeche Mode over the week, and that was really cool. So,
oh, I'm sorry, I don't really understand the question.
Oh no, I just wanted to know what are your thoughts on Erasure and the music of that?
Oh, they're fantastic and incredibly brilliant songwriters. Remarkable songwriters.
Vince Clark
great
is always
singing. Been... Yeah, he's a patent. Yes.
Do you like their earlier work, like OMR?
Yeah, I think that they've always done great stuff. They're remarkably consistent. Andy Bell's voice is really
Did you beautiful. Get the new album? The what's it called? World Be Gone? It's rather good, I thought.
Oh, I know. I haven't heard it. I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, check it out. It's just come out. It's sort of a bit more political.
I'm really glad it's good. That's really.
I'm curious.
Yeah, no, it's
you
good.
Said Depeche Mode was good.
Yeah, I'm curious. What do you think about Depeche Mode? I mean, I actually just saw them.
I love them. They're one of my favorite bands.
Yeah, I saw them live in Madison Square just a few days ago, and it's the first time I saw them. And it definitely they played a lot of tracks from the '90s, from Songs of Faith, Devotion, and Ultra. I was very excited at that, and wondering if there's a Depeche Mode influence within your music.
Oh yeah, definitely. You know, I mean, like any and all classic British synth pop, we have borrowed from fairly liberally, I'm sure.
Well, we sup at the same table there. I've been a fan of all that kind of electronic British music, and obviously the whole New Romantic period. I guess I was I grew up here, so I was quite young, and you know, you're very impressionable. And to me, I was not into the music of the '60s when I was like 10 or between 10 and 15. I was into all this kind of you know, electronic stuff and I guess some kind of post-punk and new wave stuff. So, you know, it was a very interesting. I think it's an amazing decade, the 80s. I think it's hung around a lot more than you would think. I mean, it seems to have been, you know, like a decade that just keeps repeating itself. As Colin Liddell said, he said, it's kind of almost the last real decade. I guess the 90s was real as well. But there's something post-2000, there's something hyper-real or...
I agree. It's a little depressing to me as post the mid '90s, there really hasn't been. God, I hate talking about this, but I think it's worth mentioning. There really hasn't been anything new, particularly.
Yes.
I mean, it's largely just you know derivations from 1955 to 1995. I mean, it's obviously that a remarkable, almost untouchably remarkable. Five decades or four decades for music.
It's true.
But yeah, it's been a little. It's just almost sad, I guess.
did the internet kill that? I mean,
does everyone
and everyone express themselves now through the internet and kind of go off into their little kind of like niches or because you know, I mean, there hasn't been anything like grunge or I guess they were probably the last major movements, grunge and maybe techno. And
kind of rave stuff I think was genuinely broad development. Yeah, talking to a friend of mine about it, we were just saying that maybe, and it's harkens to what you were just saying, is that you know, potentially it's just not the time. It's not the time for music to develop. I mean, it seems to be you know time for maybe. I think it's. Not particularly interesting yet, but has the potential to be interesting. I mean, it's time for.
Well, obviously, the internet is.
The internet develops.
Music develops now in smaller niches, but you know, there's no longer like a. There's no longer a pop culture that changes. Pop music pretty much has stagnated since the late '90s, but there's a small smaller niches in music. Jamie, you have your own niche, and there's stuff kind of like there's new retro wave, and there's all these subgenres.
There are many subgenres. I agree. There seems to be a kind of multiplication of subgenres and things.
But they're again subgenres.
Yes, exactly. Nothing. No new. Musical expression or it is, I guess the internet is a major phenomena in itself.
I guess that's like, it may have just replaced music.
Isn't it possible that we're all out of the loop? What if there is brilliant music being born right now and we just don't know about it?
Well, there is. I hope God there is.
I think there is.
We're talking to one right now, and obviously there are many good bands, but sometimes maybe they're not as popular, or they don't. I guess the business model has changed a bit, the way people can download things for free and stuff.
Yes.
I have a friend of mine in a band called. Are you familiar with a band called Snog? It's an Australian electronic band that.
Yeah, David Russell.
Nope.
We had him on the show.
You had him on your show, and he's a Marxist and deals with sort of conspiracy theories, critique of capitalism. I highly recommend his work, and he's found it. The money is just not there to make new albums the way it was. I mean, as an independent musician. And also, he set up a company called the Omni Recording Corporation, which releases old country and western and strange 60s and 70s, some Moog and stuff. There's a great album out called Hillbillies from Hell, which I highly recommend to you all. It's kind of popular at the moment, I think. And so you check that out. And, and he's had to sort of set up this record company to kind of compensate, I think, for, things changing. Have you felt that impact at all, Jamie?
Oh yeah, I mean it's about the most boring thing in the world to talk about, just what royalty checks were and what they have gone from. But yeah, obviously, we've been a band for 15 years and we started kind of at the very end of when people still bought a lot of records. So we had that for a couple of years and now it's pretty negligible. It's an old story at this point also.
You can't replace a live show, and obviously touring has become more important for contemporary bands today. You obviously would agree with that.
Oh yeah, I mean we used to tour 3 months a year, and now we tour like 7 months a year. There's just kind of no other way to do it.
Yeah,
without having a day job. Yeah.
And you live in Los Angeles, do you?
Mm-hmm. What city do you live in?
I live in Melbourne, in the southern city.
So you grew up in LA. What are your thoughts on how LA has changed since you grew up?
Oh, it's much better. It sucked when I was a kid. The crime was way worse. The smog was much worse. The traffic was worse. The social politics were crime and smog and traffic and fuck social politics. But it's a much more pleasant and vibrant and cohesive place to be. I mean, there's still a tremendous amount of sadness and decrepitude and horror in the city, as there are in any big city. But it is not to the degree that it was when I was a kid. How's Melbourne now versus when you were a kid?
Well, it's become a certain different country a bit the last 25 years. With it's a lot more multicultural. There's a large Asian community and there's a growing Arab community here. But basically it's the same country. Australians are very easygoing, really. That's why I think the gay marriage thing is going to get up, because basically we don't care. We're like, just let everyone get on with it, get on with their life. They want to do something. As long as it's not hurting children or animals, go ahead. You know what I mean? So, that's the kind of thing. It's easygoing country. And I've done my best to, cause a bit of trouble down here with this S&M club I ran, and obviously this Melbourne Underground Film Festival I run, which is like an independent cinema event that supports, low-budget micro-budget filmmaking and crap. So, there's a lot of interesting things going here. Melbourne's the more cultured city. It's a bit more like a European city. Sydney's a bit more like...
Yeah, I've gotten that impression when I've been there.
I think on our last show, Jamie, you mentioned that you met Peter Soto. So what are your thoughts on him and the controversies around him?
My thoughts on him as a person, or my thoughts about the controversy about his earlier work?
The controversies about his earlier works.
Um, Well, I think I feel mixed about it, as everybody does, and I'm sure that he does as well.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting.
I think he has a mixed motivation for doing it. I mean, sometimes the answer to that kind of thing is not clear.
Yes. I mean, I'm not a fan.
Okay.
I'm not a fan, but his work is certainly interesting, and it's pushing things into a certain area, I guess.
I would say we're a fan of it. I mean...
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I'm very affected by it, and I have gotten a lot out of it, but I mean, I can't say that I enjoy it. I don't think, I mean, it's certainly not meant to be enjoyed. I think it's meant to be moving in one particular way or another.
He was part of that counterculture milieu a bit that, you know, I mean, growing up in the 80s and 90s, there was like Research Magazine and... And Feral House Publishing, Adam Parfrey, and obviously Boyd Rice, and people connected to him, and... And there's a whole kind of network. I mean, I don't know what this movement is called. It's like the anti-Beat Generation or something.
Apocalypse culture, you want to call it.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe.
Apocalypse culture, there you go. That's a good tag.
That's probably a good way to put it, yeah.
I'd like to ask Jamie one question. What are your thoughts on animal rights activism? And I guess, what is your favorite animal, too?
Oh, well, I mean, I'm a... for all intents and purposes, I'm like a total, like, pessimistic, nihilistic hippie, I guess. I mean, I have been a vegan for 25 years and, you know, and I'm about as sentimental as it comes to any ultra lefty kind of politics you can think of. But then again, I fucking hate everybody. I'm pro animal rights. I mean, eating meat. I usually keep my mouth kind of shut about it because I don't want to intrude on anybody else's choices, but I think it's, and you're asking, so I think it's pretty fucking reprehensible.
I think Morrissey's stance, and that's always been interesting. I always found his stance. And my friend David Thrussell from that band Snog, he's a vegan like yourself.
Pilliter, didn't you see those murals for PETA when you were in New York?
What's that? Murals.
Pilliter, you said you saw.
Oh, yeah. The Alicia Silverstone vegan. Of course, Robert, I've seen those. But I for vegetarian stuff, I was a vegetarian when I was like a teenager. But I just wanted to ask Jamie his favorite animal because my favorite animals are seals.
Oh, that's a good choice. I have to go, but I think it would be nice for me at least to hear what everyone's favorite animal is, and then I got split.
All right. No, we should wrap up then.
Well, I love frogs. There you go. I like frogs. That's my favorite.
Yeah, frogs is a good choice.
Yeah, same here.
Fantastic. And they're under threat. Save the frogs, ladies and gentlemen. There's a good PC message that I can totally back. You know?
It was very nice to talk to you guys. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, thank you, man. Have a good night.
Jamie.
Good night.
Thanks for your time.
Bye.
Jamie, that was great having you on. We're going to be continuing our discussion. So, should we continue with the animal rights topic? What do you think?
Why not? I mean, I think that's it's an interesting issue. I'm glad. I consider myself someone of the right, at least to some extent, but I think right-wingers often get a bad rap that they don't like things like the environment, that they don't like things like protecting animals. Of course, many don't, and obviously back politics that can be quite destructive in relation to the environment and in relation to a natural habitat. But, you know, I do think there are people on the right who do value these things. I would consider myself someone. I'm not the kind of person who's marching in green, green protest marches or that kind of thing, but I'm interested in deep ecology, the philosophy of someone like Martin Heidegger, kind of dwelling on the earth. He's got an almost kind of anti-technological kind of perspective. It's kind of spelled out in a book called The Question Concerning Technology. And he was obviously a right-winger himself. And I think you can see it also in Nietzsche and in many other right-wing intellectuals. So I think that it is interesting that, there is a right-wing green movement and there is a right-wing animal rights movement. I guess maybe they should be more vocal and articulate themselves a little better. And they should probably not follow the mighty dollar. As I think that's one of the great errors of the right in the last 30, 40 years, probably since Reagan, the kind of economic libertarianism that's become such a huge part of right-wing politics in Western civilization, which I think is not actually truly what the right-wing is. It should be about conservative means conservation, doesn't it? So that's quite green. in a way. What do you think about that kind of nexus?
Yeah, I think definitely we should support conservation.
I think there's a lot of people who think animals are people too, and those people are kind of the radical.
Well, the thing is, one extreme thinks that animals are people, and then the other side thinks animals are just a commodity, and that's the kind of mentality behind factory farming.
They're both. People as well are people in relation to commodities.
People are a commodity.
Yeah.
Heidegger talks about this as well in his philosophy. Heidegger talks about modern technology has somehow made a product of everything, including human beings. That through a thing called the Gestell, which is a German word that sort of means like the nexus or the matrix, or it's a way that the technology controls the way, obviously right now, the way we express ourselves. It's almost like he puts us into a grid, and this grid can be destructive, and we can't control it, we can't fully control it. We can control it to some extent, but there's an element in the way that technological development, like when you discover something like the science that can invent, say, a nuclear power plant, but also a nuclear bomb, you have this interesting kind of Pandora's box going on with technology. And people always say it's religion that will destroy the world. Religion is a great evil. But, people have had religion for 5,000 years and they've been throwing rocks and, spears at each other. But it's modern technology that's going to really wipe out the world, and obviously overpopulation. And the issue of overpopulation is another issue that greenies never want to touch. But obviously that's a major, major issue. And I've always been attracted to actually green radicals. I remember from research publications like Earth First, they did articles on that. And, I've always been interested in left-wing radicals as well, like Bader Meinhof. And I've just always been interested in radicalism. A friend of mine, Matthew Clayfield, who's a journalist, called himself a radical centrist. And that's actually probably closer to what I probably am in many ways.
Yeah, or alt-center. The alt-center is where the alt-right and the alt-left overlap.
I thought it was interesting. I just wanted to butt in for a bit, but I thought it was interesting that I know we were talking about the alt-right, and we should talk about the stance about where the alt-right is today, because I do see whatever we want to call it, alt-center or apocalypse culture or whatnot, but I think the Unite the Right, especially on the rally a month ago, has been a controversy for a lot of people who, used to associate, if I wasn't exactly identitarian because we had the actual National Socialist show up, and that people got a little stinked over that.
I'd like to state my opinion on that, because I think, obviously Jamie had a fairly strong reaction to the topic of the alt-right, which is fair enough in many ways.
Well, I also made a video called Fuck the Unite the Right, too, because I was there and I was quite upset.
Hey, guys, I'm gonna dip out. I got to go.
All right.
Okay, we can continue. Take care, Harlem.
Bye, Harlem.
Have a good night. Bye.
Bye-bye. And, I think, in relation to I just lost my train of thought just then. What were we talking about this
before? We're talking about Unite the Right and how it affected the alt-right and it's recovering and what people alt-center take on it, or because I was critical of it too. So
I think the alt-right made a huge error. And when it first appeared, I've written essays for the alternative right that Colin Liddell and Andy Nowicki edit. I've written a few essays on Donald Trump.
That one's down.
That site was, basically vanished, Pinochet style, after the Charlottesville, which actually shocked me, because obviously something like Daily Stormer, I've never liked that site.
The thing is, both Andy and Colin went out of their way to denounce the Daily Stormer, and they still got taken down.
Yes, it's kind of, it is interesting, but I do think the alt-right made a big mistake, that it should have disavowed, when Trump won, it was clear that they would use that as some kind of weapon, and they should have disavowed what's called the 1488 element or the neo-Nazi element. I think it's only a small fraction of actually what, because I think a lot of people are alt-right when I have conversations, at least in a alt-light, that's what we like to call it. And a lot of people have an alt-light perspective these days. People like Stephen Molyneux, Gavin McInnes, Alex Jones, obviously he gets a bit carried away with his lizards and things, but you know what I mean? There's something interesting about this Paul Joseph Watson. There's something Robert Stark, and there's something interesting about this whole nexus of people. And I think it's
you know, they're not, the majority of people are not neo-Nazis. They're not dressing up. They don't have tattoos or swastikas. I mean, when you say neo-Nazi, I think of like a working class guy or a lower working class guy who doesn't have a job, who's just got a swastika tattoo and a beer. And, you know, when the CBS cameras go on him, he starts, you know, spouting racial epithet. I mean, this is ridiculous. You know, this should have nothing to do with a kind of new political movement that I thought the alt-right was trying to become. So I'm sort of distancing myself a bit because of that, I think. And
so then we get to this whole concept called an alt-center or a radical center. Do you see that going anywhere?
Look, I just think they're good ideas. They're good political ideas, and they're bad political ideas. And, you know, I think both sides of politics have good ideas. I've always thought that the left has always been on the money in relation to the economy, in relation to making the economy more equal for people and creating some kind of social, you want to call it socialism, but basically the kind of safety net that we have in Australia and in many European countries and to some extent in the United Kingdom, like free healthcare, to a certain extent, free education, you know, things along these lines. I think in a country as rich as America has no excuse. If they can afford $5 trillion wars, they can afford to have a basic kind of Medicare system like Australia. Donald Trump got together with Malcolm Turnbull, who's our prime minister, and he said to Turnbull, Australia has a better healthcare system than the United States, and it absolutely does. And I mean, I will sing the praises of the socialist healthcare system in Australia because it saved my life. I had a liver disorder when I was 27 in the late 90s, and I didn't have health insurance. And I went to a local hospital, and basically they cured me. I was in the hospital for about 2 or 3 weeks. Obviously, I wouldn't be here otherwise. And you know, that kind of changed me. I was probably a little bit more of an economic libertarian because I was running a business that was successful, the Hellfire Clubs. And I was, you know, kind of a bit of an entrepreneur, and I've always had that kind of flavor to me a bit, but kind of awoken to me the importance of a safety net. And, you know, I've always studied Marx. I have at least an entire shelf of books on Marxist theory and different various Marxists like, you know, Gramsci, Althusser, a whole bunch of people, even the more modern people like Zizek, who I like a lot, who's, and also signals a bit right on some things and, you know, critiques political correctness. And
who was that colleague of yours who calls himself alt-center?
His name is Matthew Clayfield. He calls himself a radical centrist. And, I mean, I'd heard that term thrown around in alt-right circles to a certain extent. I mean, to me, the whole thing that was interesting about the alt-right is that it was a kind of, I did a university degree on political philosophy. Yeah, I've always been a kind of right-wing socialist. But when I say socialist, I don't mean like, you know, like Mao or Stalin or even Castro. I mean socialists like Sweden and Australia. Obviously, I want to keep the free market to a certain extent. I think it's just a matter of attuning things. And I think, you know, I think when we have a reaction to people, whether they be left or right, whether they be Marxist or alt-right or I don't know. I mean, someone like Jeffrey Tucker is someone who's really interesting, who's an economic libertarian. You know, I often disagree with economic libertarians, but I often read his articles on Fee, and he's a friend of mine on Facebook. His articles are incredibly lucid and just like very intelligent articles that explain the power of the free market system. And I think there are a lot of problems with that. And I'll admit that. And I've had a few arguments with him on his page, but there's a great power to that. So, you know, I've just always been a political vulture that examines different things, that has been interested in radicalism, but without the nastiness, you know, so to speak. Without, you know, Stalin's gulags and Hitler's...
And Richard, you're on cultural issues, you're fairly libertine. You're not really a hardcore social conservative.
No, obviously, you know, I am a social libertarian. You know, I may end up voting yes in this gay marriage vote. Simply, I do have some caveats in relation to it, you know, in relation to it, an agenda of it being taught in schools and, you know, that we, you know, the kind of, you know, thought crime that comes with it. You can't, you know, say anything against it once it becomes law, you know, various things like that. Or say, for example, a religious group or a religious church doesn't want to perform a gay wedding. I think they have a right, if they want to do that. But then obviously there are many other churches that will marry gay people. So, you know, I don't think we should make too much of that, and people should have their freedom for diverse opinion, you know, and I think that's important. I think that's part of, neoliberalism in many ways, you know. So, you know, I think it's a fascinating time. And obviously, there's been a huge kind of political kind of upheaval in the last 2 or 3 years. And what Hillary Clinton represented definitely failed. And that I think that the old right is back to some extent. under the guise of the new right, you know, and what Trump is doing, what Brexit represented, maybe some of what Le Pen is doing and Nigel Farage. But also really interesting is what, you know, Bernie Sanders is doing and what Jeremy Corbyn is doing. These are legitimate. These people are not Stalin or Mao. And I think that, you know, the relationship between neo-Nazis and the alt-right should be the way the relationship between, say, the new left and, say, Stalinists and Maoists. Now, there are bound to be Stalinists and Maoists within the new left. Now, they should just be like a polite embarrassment, or maybe they're even sympathetic to some of the ideas, or they talk about it, and they post pictures of Stalin about how they're going to, you know, I don't know, make jokes, you know. And obviously the alt-right does that in relation to 1488 stuff a bit. But, like, that's the way it should be seen. And but I think it's pretty clear that the new left disavows Stalinism and Maoism, and I don't think that the new right has made that distinction apropos of what could be called, the, you know, neo-Nazism or neo-fascism. So, you know, I think that's a very important thing, distinction to make, and I don't think many people really make it. So, you know, that's it there, I guess.
You know, I think it's interesting, too, that when we're talking about politics, that right now I don't think the new left or the left-wing school is producing any new artists. It's just a policy. The only people who are practicing left-wing things are baby boomers and Gen Xers who are trying to hold on to Zizek or something like that. Pretty much in urban or metrosexual areas, you'll find people saying, I don't like fascism, or they read, like, weird left-wing anarchist books and hang out those shops, but they're not producing really good art because that's just producing the Antifa, which are going around in America and about. And I think as well, the alt-right has produced unique artists like, you know, Greg Johnson, James J. O'Mara, or, you know, some of the obscure people like that. And I guess on when we're talking about an alt-center, we have, you know, the Stark Truth and, you know, I guess people like Jamie and Richard or Richard, you know, that are kind of apocalypse culture, or at least that it's more avant-garde to focus, and the politics is an outcome of the art you make. And I think that's a very interesting thing because now we're having our own personal ideologies and things like that. So I guess there's this weird stance that new politics make new art. And right now, the bad paradigm of the left is it's bad because it's not producing any good art. Like,
if you look at the, you know, if you look at the old left, if you look at the old left, it valued freedom of speech, it valued freedom of expression, you know, it basically is very much almost the polar opposite of what the left is today in many ways. So I think the left has undergone a kind of change the last 25 years. And also the left, as I mentioned before, occupies what's called the dominant cultural discourse space in mainstream media, obviously US media to a certain extent, outside of Fox News and Breitbart, and obviously a lot of Australian media, and also worldwide Western media to a certain extent. So, you know, I mean, in a way, it's almost the establishment now, this kind of left, the new left, you know, social justice warrior kind of politics, cultural Marxism. But there's a lot of other really good ideas on the old left. And the most important one is obviously economic inequity and also economic, you know, like making things more equitable. And fairer unions and things like that. You know, I supported Donald Trump in the US election and Jeremy Corbyn in the United Kingdom one. So, you know, I studied Hegel when I studied political philosophy, and I'm interested in dialectics. So when we talk about an alt-center, that would be a combination of something like alt-left, alt-right, and, you know, it meets up in the middle and you take interesting ideas.
So you're saying that you could get on board with an alt-center?
Well, look, you know, I don't particularly like labels a lot. I liked the alt-right a little bit because it was dangerous and a bit naughty. And it also, that Paul Joseph Watson released that video that, you know, the new right or the alt-right or whatever you want to call it is the new counterculture. And I think to a certain extent it is. And I'll tell you, because obviously I posted a lot of stuff on my Facebook pages along those lines. I don't put necessarily all these ideas in my movies or my film festival or my nightclub events or whatever, but I do sometimes. But I think those ideas are very, I don't know, they're just out there at the moment. You know, things, concerns over mass immigration, you know, I don't think left-wingers can ignore this anymore.
That topic isn't explicit in your movie.
No, it isn't. I mean, and I've never tried to lecture anybody politically through my work. I just put different ideas in it and let people, you know, judge for themselves to a certain extent. Pearls Before Swine would probably be a film that's probably my most right-wing film. Obviously, Boyd Rice is somebody who's connected to a kind of proto-alt-right or in a way, or, you know, he was kind of a very interesting counterculture figure. And, you know, I read a lot of his writings in the early 90s in, you know, places like Research and
Burl House, and that's how I contacted him to make that film with him.
Does Pearls Before Swine have a reference to Dasad?
It does. You know, obviously at the time I was running a kind of S&M club, so, you know, obviously that, and I think a lot of conservatives would probably have a problem with the fact that I, you know, I'm very much a sexual libertarian, you know, and...
Have you actually read any of Dasad's books?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I was very much influenced by the Marquis de Sade. The Hellfire Club itself was an English gentleman's club that was around the time of the Marquis de Sade. So I actually found out about the name, the Hellfire Club, through...
I heard that the film Solo, 120 Days in Sodom, was actually banned in Australia. And then one of that, also the film, I think it was Ken Park, that film was banned in Australia too.
Oh yeah, Larry Clark's great. I love his films.
And Bruce LaBruce's L.A. Zombie, which we played at the Melbourne Underground Film Festival. We did a public disobedience.
Did you play the Larry Clark's film in the Melbourne Underground?
Which one?
I think the one that was banned.
Ken Park? Or?
Yeah, Ken Park. That was the one that was banned.
I don't think we did. We played the Bruce LaBruce film. We played Salo at one stage. We've always, you know, championed free speech. And this year we're playing The Red Pill and Vaxxed. Which is probably going to cause some controversy at the Melbourne Underground Film Festival because, you know, I just believe in freedom of speech. And no other major film festival or even indie film festival has played those two films in a festival environment in Australia. And I thought, you know, it's important to, you know, raise these debates. And, you know, I mean, for example, Vaxxed, I'm in two minds about that. I think there may be some dangers in relation to autism apropos vaccines. I'm not entirely sure. Obviously, they save people from like 100 other diseases. So, you know, maybe that's just the compromise. But maybe there's also a way to... alter them so if there is an autism side effect that can be altered, and maybe just talking about it can improve the science if there is any legs to it, or maybe it is just a conspiracy theory like lizards and, you know, I don't know what else, you know, going around. But, you know, I just think these issues should be spoken about, and the thing about the new left is it wants to silence a lot of these things, and, you know, the way it shuts down people like Milo who want to speak on campus. And, you know, I mean, Milo's basically a lot of fun. I mean, obviously he got into trouble over that comment, and they thought they killed him, but I've noticed he's back posting a lot of stuff now. You know, once the media cycle moves on 2 or 3 months, it's not that big a deal. I've always admired what he had to say. I mean, don't always agree with it, but he's a fun personality. And, he you know, I like people who you know, upset the apple cart and, you know, what's it called, fly in the face of what, you know, what will be considered the establishment. And right now the establishment is the left. So, you know, I think that that's why I think that the new right or the alt-right has a kind of cachet of underground. And I would probably disagree with Jamie. I don't think everybody associated with the alt-right should be dead or whatever. But I do think a lot of people, if you just read mainstream media about the alt-right, you would probably think everybody connected to it is a neo-Nazi. And obviously I've been accused of being that. I'm simply not.
Do you think that apocalypse culture of Parfrey, Boyd Rice, Jim Goad, Sodas was sort of a precursor to the alt-right?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, my film in a way is a prophecy of it. I even produced my own political theory. I mean, obviously I was studying political philosophy, and everyone else is like, was doing like something on Lacan and like some, you know, like, you know, textual analysis of Derrida and Lacan or Nietzsche and Lacan. And I just thought that sounded like just, you know, basically just footnotes onto other people's philosophy. So I decided to invent my own political philosophy, which I called Transcendental Fascism. I was inspired by the Transcendental Meditation logo, but I mean, I was you know, everyone in the class, obviously in my philosophy class, was left wing. So declaring yourself a transcendental fascist, or at least interested in that side of politics, instantly just, you know, got me a lot of kind of dirty looks. But then, you know, I would explain what I meant by it. And in a way, I think this kind of alt-right is an expression of that kind of idea. It's also about transcending fascism.
It's transcendental fascism prior to the creation of the alt-right.
Yeah. I wrote my thesis on it in 2001. So, you know, which I'm going to publish actually on my blog or somewhere else if someone else wants to publish it. But yeah, a lot of the ideas in that, it's based on, you know, some ideas that are in Heidegger and Nietzsche. And, you know, just the kind that there would be a new kind of right that would rise in the next 10 or 15 years. And obviously that was what Pearls Before Swine was about. And also it lectured about the danger of it, the violence associated with it. So, you know, I mean, I don't say that I am, you know, just... what you call, like, you know, openly like cheerleading something like that. I'm aware it's a very slippery slope. I would say I support limiting immigration and things like that, and possibly deporting people who are, like, you know,
jihadists or who are openly hostile to Western civilization. But then, you know, I mean, once you begin to get into the area of deporting people, you know, it's a very slippery slope. And, you know, you can just see, I can see danger on the right side of politics just as much as I can see danger on the left. You know, the way that if you go too far down the road of, say, Bernie Sanders, you do end up with something like Castro, you know, where the economy is in the toilet. And you do need to pay attention to someone like Jeffrey Tucker and economic libertarianism, people like Milton Friedman, von Mises, and people like this, Hayek, who kind of explicated the value of free market capitalism to raise the standard of living of people, which it has done to a certain extent. But it has also brought with it an environmental crisis, and it's also it does somehow enable the rich, because the people who most benefit from economic libertarianism are the rich. And I think you must be aware of that if you you know, everyone on the right, because if I mention socialism in alt-right circles, like, they want to take me on a helicopter ride, throw me over.
I think there needs to be a new tradition, and I think we're doing this right now. And this new tradition should be the revival of some apocalypse culture, or Robert calls it alt-center, but I like apocalypse culture. I express my own views through Asian-Aryanism, but that's only just a very small Asian niche, you know. I could go in the future and get homonationalism.com and talk about homosexuality and white nationalism. But I think Asian-Aryanism and homonationalism should fall under the giant umbrella called apocalypse culture. And I think there needs to be a defense, or at least some party or decolation for a new apocalypse culture. I mean, there's only Parfrey's 1 and 2, but I wish there was more of a Wikipedia page describing this as the movement that we're associated in.
I think that Adam Parfrey, Boyd Rice, Jim Gore, these guys were all part of this kind of apocalypse culture, particularly obviously Adam, who sort of invented it really in a way, at least the term. And, it kind of ties into a kind of millennial ideas of end times. It's almost vaguely biblical. Many people, at least back then, they were interested in Satanism. I know Boyd was interested in Satanism. Adam was interested in Satanism. I mean, I was running the Hellfire Club, for God's sake. You know what I mean? I never practiced the occult. I met Kenneth Anger once when he came to Australia. He gave a talk at my Hellfire Club, and we hung out. And he was originally going to be in Pearls Before Swine, but he ended up not being able to do it.
Was Kenneth Anger? I think he knew Crowley.
Oh, Kenneth Anger is an occultist and very, very powerful one. Very powerful. And one of the reasons I have an interest in religion now is because from doing the Hellfire Club and I studied Crowley and many occultists and met Kenneth Anger. This is real. Let me just tell you that right now. It's very, very real, this stuff. And, if you really know what you're doing with it, like someone like Kenneth Anger or someone like Douglas P. from Death and June, or you can... It has a real power that you can use for good or bad or whatever you want to do with it. So there is definitely something to it. And I know this is a fact. And once I began to realize that there was something to the occult, obviously I studied Carl Jung as well at university. My professor, Robert Farrell, was a kind of Jungian Heideggerian, which is an interesting mix. And, there's something to it. And, once you know the occult is real, or at least the metaphysical dimension, at least some metaphysical dimension of the occult is real, then all of religion becomes possible, at least the idea of a monotheistic God. So I've become interested in Christian theology. And obviously this new film, and you talk about apocalypse culture, that's almost the theme of my new film, The Second Coming, Volume 1, which is a very apocalyptic poem written by William Butler Yeats in 1921.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Richard Wollstonecraft for being the second guest for the second half of the show.
Yeah, my pleasure, mate. And it's good to have a chat. And it's great to have a chat to Jamie, who's a great musician. And I'm going to make sure I get hold of his last two or three albums that I haven't got yet. And I think it's great to get people talking like this. And I think you guys do great work with your podcasts. And I'm always happy to participate.
And also, thanks, Pilater.
It's always nice to be on.
Thank you, Pilater. Thank you, Robert.